You're listening to Women's Media Center Live with Robin Morgan.
Welcome to Women's Media Center Live. I'm Robin Morgan. And it was great to be away for a week doing promotion and the first launch reading of my book, Dark Matter, New Poems, my latest baby. And when I do future readings around the country, I'll be sure and let you folks know in case you want to pop by. But that was a very rewarding and delightful week. But it's also real good to be back, particularly when my guest today is Christine Lottie, who happens to be a previous guest on this program, as well as an Academy Award winner, an Emmy winner, and a Golden Globe winner. And today is here in a brand new capacity as a writer. And we're going to be discussing her great new book. But before we do any of that, we are going to go, you and I, inside the headlines. It would be an exercise in utter madness to try and catch up with 2 weeks of news when the news cycle is now 20 seconds long. Iran treaty abandoned. Korea on again, off again. Glad about released prisoners, but not reassured about any deals made between two psychotic males. Michael Avenatti versus Michael Cohen. Former New York City Mayor Rudy Giuliani auditioning for a permanent residence in the Surrealism Corner. Melania Trump plagiarizing Michelle Obama again. Trump considering himself for the Nobel Peace Prize, the Nobel Prize for Literature, not being awarded at all this year because of Me Too scandals at the Swedish Academy, in which an Academy associate sexually assaulted numerous women over 20 years, including the Crown Princess of Sweden herself. Me Too-inspired accusations erupting about liberal hero New York State District Attorney Eric Schneiderman and at the Liberal Center for American Progress. The left is always shocked, shocked, shocked when good men do bad things. I'm not. All men are born into privilege and feelings of entitlement over women, feelings that are both involved with and completely compartmentalized from whatever else their politics are. For that matter, women entering male systems face the challenge of resisting the systems changing them, or them changing the system. The latter really occurs only when a critical mass of women are in that system and can change it. The former, the system changing the woman, well, gives us examples like Gina Haspel, Trump's nominee to head the CIA. She seems eminently qualified, and I, for one, would like to see a woman lead that agency, but not one who refuses to state before Congress that she thinks torture is a moral issue, and hiding the truth about it was a bad thing. She can't do that. Forget about it. So let's return to the original intent of this segment, which is news that falls between the cracks, that is, inside the headlines. The Environmental Protection Agency has announced a new regulation that would restrict the kinds of scientific studies the agency can use when it develops policies, a move critics claim will permanently weaken the agency's ability to protect public health. The EPA, under this measure, will require that the underlying data for all scientific studies used by the agency to formulate policies on air and water regulations be publicly available. Well, that sounds great, but actually would sharply limit the number of studies available for consideration because much research relies on confidential health data from study subjects. Scott Pruitt, the EPA administrator who never met a corruption he didn't immediately engage in, announced that, quote, the science we use is going to be transparent. Actually, Scott, what we'd like is for your expenditures, your private trips, your support of industry moguls to be transparent instead. For instance, champions of your new plan included the chemical and fossil fuel industries and prominent climate change deniers. but public health and environmental groups have vowed to challenge the move in court, and the public will be given 30 days to offer comments on the proposal before a final rule is issued. So if you feel like snowing the EPA with comments, enjoy yourself. The Iowa legislature has passed a bill that would be the nation's strictest abortion law in a move intended to pose an aggressive challenge to Roe v. Wade and to reignite right-wing energy before the midterm elections in November. Other states, including North Dakota and Arkansas, have passed similarly prohibitive measures and have seen them voided by the courts. But these new attempts would undo the now constitutional right of a woman to decide to abort by making that decision illegal at only 6 weeks into her pregnancy, when sometimes the tiniest flicker of an embryonic heartbeat can be detected on an ultrasound. It's at that point the friends of the fetus would settle for outlawing abortion, since their position, of course, is that life begins at conception. The rate of maternal mortality in the United States is already higher than any other wealthy country, but it has risen by more than half since 1990, and that's largely because of alarmingly high rates among black women, who are nationally 3 times as likely to die in pregnancy or childbirth as white women. In New York City, the numbers are even more staggering. African American women here are 12 times as likely to die from childbirth-related causes as European American women are. They experience life-threatening severe complications from pregnancy and childbirth at triple the rate of white New Yorkers and roughly comparable to rates in Sierra Leone. The New York Times Magazine and ProPublica laid out more shameful details, including the appalling finding that wealthier, more educated black women in New York City are also dying or almost dying in childbirth at a far higher rate than their white neighbors. One city study found that black college-educated women were more than twice as likely to experience severe complications from childbirth as white women without a high school diploma. Latinas and Asian women also experience higher rates of severe, potentially life-threatening complications. Researchers feel strongly that the higher rates of death and complications among women of color are caused only partly by long-standing disparities in poverty, obesity, and lack of access to top-grade health care. On the contrary, researchers say, the dangers these women face in pregnancy and childbirth are compounded by racism, biases in healthcare, and the long-term anxieties, regardless of economic status, that come with simply being an American woman of color. Time to look abroad. India seems to be trying to compete with Congo as the rape capital of the world. Authorities arrested 15 people in connection with the gang rape and murder of a teenage girl, the latest in a recent string of high-profile crimes against women. The men are accused of raping the 16-year-old girl multiple times after kidnapping her from Chhatra, a village in eastern India, while she was attending a family member's wedding. When she was released the next day, village leaders imposed a fine the equivalent of about $750 on Danu Biunian, the young man who was said to have orchestrated her abduction. That ruling angered him and other men in the community, and they beat the girl's family for daring to complain about the treatment of just a daughter. While the girl's family argued with community members, Danu Biunia slipped away from the crowd, cornered the girl in her home, and lit her on fire. He escaped through a window, but was ultimately captured. The rape conviction rates remain permanently low in India, and the news media are dominated by reports of other horrific crimes against women, including the use and abuse of women and girls as hostages in grudges and battles between Hindu fundamentalists and Muslims. In Spain, the case was seen as a bellwether for women's rights. the sentencing of five men for sexually assaulting a woman during the bull running festival at Pamplona. The men, who called themselves Manada, or Wolfpack, had even texted each other, bragging about it. But to the public's shock, the courts cleared them of raping her. The five men were sentenced to 9 years in prison for, quote, continuous sexual abuse, rather than the almost 23 years in prison the prosecution had sought for rape. The woman's lawyer plans to appeal the ruling, and the government of Navarre, the region of Pamplona, where the case was heard, said it would back the appeal. The case could go as far as the Spanish Supreme Court. The attack has become a symbol of the aggressive machismo women suffer from in Spain. It was also one of several assaults reported during the bull running festival in 2016, despite stepped-up police presence. The judges in the case tried to defend their verdict after mass protests broke out, with more than 35,000 people gathered in Pamplona and large protests also taking place in Madrid and every other city in Spain. The Pamplona case has now turned into a Spanish version of the Me Too movement, a Spanish hashtag, Cuéntalo, or Tell Your Story, has gone viral and is being used not only by ordinary citizens, but by prominent women journalists, writers, and even politicians. Well, we know there's got to be good news somewhere, and sure enough, for the first time, the new director of the Air and Space Museum is a woman, Ellen Stofan, a former chief scientist at NASA who brings more than 25 years of field experience to the job. She says, "You want to normalize these things. On the other hand, I've spent my entire career being one of the few women in the room, and I understand the significance of being able to say that women are starting to take on these positions." And last, Sarah Zorn is the first female regimental commander, the top cadet at South Carolina's military college, the Citadel. The Citadel fought tooth and nail against admitting women, and it took a 2.5-year battle in the courts to force the school to accept Shannon Faulkner in 1995. Faulkner fought that fight. She endured sexist epithets spray-painted on her parents' house. She endured death threats, and federal marshals were needed to escort her to campus on her first day as a cadet. She did eventually drop out, felled by freak heat waves that engulfed the southern region. And when Sarah Zorn applied for admission 4 years ago, she hadn't even heard the story of Shannon Faulkner, the first woman to gain admission to the famed Southern Military College, the woman who made her own attendance possible. Today, the Citadel is proud of its first female regimental commander, but it was Sharon Faulkner and her courage that breached the Citadel and commanded it to change. It's time for a quick break here at Women's Media Center Live. I'm Robin Morgan, and I'll be right back with the Surrealism Corner.
You're listening to Women's Media Center Live with Robin Morgan.
And we're back, right in time for the Surrealism Corner. Here we go through the looking glass into the upside-down world. First, a few one-liners. Rudolph Giuliani, period. So-called Judge Roy Moore, the former Senate candidate from Alabama accused of pursuing teenage girls, has sued four of his accusers, claiming they have defamed him. No, comedian Michelle Wolf did not kill the White House Correspondents' Dinner in doing precisely what she was hired to do, skewing both politicians and the press. Yes, New York Times op-ed columnist Ross Douthat was wildly offensive. In his piece about incels, short for involuntary celibates, perhaps having a right to women and the redistribution of sex, close quote. I'll take an extra sentence here to point out that neither sex nor women are things, objects, or products. Sex is a biological fact and also an activity. And, surprise, women are human beings. None of the three can be redistributed. Oh my God! Women are expected to lean in and get rich, we're told, to not fear success or wealth as if we did. Talk about blame the victim. Less than 10% of U.S. portfolio managers at mutual funds and exchange-traded funds are women. Special item for New Yorkers. Gotham was adopted as a name for New York City early in the 19th century. You know why? It was copying the name of the English village whose inhabitants had pretended madness to fool the king's tax collectors. There you go, Batman. And Robin, of course. Just as Charlie Rose was making noises about a comeback, an additional 27 women, 14 at CBS and 13 who'd worked with him elsewhere, came forth to say he had sexually harassed them and that they had brought their concerns to management at the time, only to be ignored. As the comebacks are attempted, sisters, keep those accusations coming. Now to some slightly longer items. Pennsylvania State House Republican Representative Tara Tuhill needs a security officer at her elbow whenever she's in the State House, in her office, at committee hearings, or at debates and votes. This is because a few feet away is a fellow Republican, Representative Nick Micarelli, whom she used to date, but against whom she now has an order of protection. She claims he kicked her, punched her, pinned her to the wall by the neck, brandished a gun, and threatened to kill them both when she tried to break up with him. After an internal House investigation found her complaints to be credible, along, by the way, with those of another woman, a political consultant, Republican leaders called on Micarelli to resign. But he flatly refused, and the House Speaker refuses to expel him. Hence the bodyguards. I would remind you, these are all supposed lawmakers, remember? The Justice Department these days is consistently inconsistent. It has issued new directives addressing sexual harassment, although critics say the new rules could be unevenly applied across the department, leaving some employees totally unprotected. The new policies, written by Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein and two other officials in his office, were drafted in response to a 48-page report by Michael Horowitz, the department's inspector general, last year, describing harassment, assault, and sexual misconduct. The new directions are intended to ensure that the department meets out, quote, serious and consistent punishment to those found guilty of sexual harassment, and that each section in the department is held accountable. The new directives also include sections on the tracking of claims, on accounting for allegations before giving an employee an award or other public commendation, and the various levels of punishment. But the guidelines allow each unit to decide how best to enforce many of the new directives, and different sections have different reputations concerning how they treat employees. There are 115,000 staff members of the Justice Department. Kathy Harris, an employment lawyer, has been cited saying, "The question this raises is who does the Department of Justice prioritize? Right now, they're worried about being sued by harassers. They should worry about being sued by the victims whose claims are ignored. Meanwhile, in case you're not already dizzy enough with Justice Department inconsistencies, this next one is a red alert surreal. The Trump administration has removed certain sections from the Justice Department manual, its handbook for federal prosecutors. Gone are sections on the public's right to know, on the need for a free press, and on the need for a public trial. Deleted are any references to the department's work on racial gerrymandering. Language about limits on prosecutorial power has been edited down. Added to the manual, on the other hand, is a brand new section underscoring Attorney General Jeff Sessions' focus on, quote, religious liberty, and new sections reminding employees to report any concerns to their superiors and requiring them to disclose any contacts they have with the media. Sig Heil. After that one, we really need a bit of positive news, even in the surrealism corner. So, humpback whales who live and breed near Antarctica in the southern oceans seem to be making a comeback, with females having a high pregnancy rate and giving birth to more calves in recent years. Humpback whales were nearly hunted out of existence in the late 19th and much of the 20th century until treaties were signed to stop their killing and protections were initiated for Antarctica. Welcome back to one of the oldest, largest, smartest creatures on Earth. You deserve this planet. Not at all sure about humans. Speaking of which, although no one has yet found a fossil of the original animal, two scientists in Britain have reconstructed its genome, offering an important clue as to how the animal kingdom arose, with an evolutionary burst of new genes that may have played a crucial part in transforming our single-celled ancestors into creatures with complex bodies made of many kinds of cells. It's a long, complex, and awesome story about the examining of 1.5 million genes. But the fortune cookie version is that of all the genes in the human genome, 55% were already present in that first animal, which likely lived over 650 million years ago. That's pretty humbling in case you were feeling highly evolved. Frankly, you and I and all of us humans are just surreal. Time for another quick break here at Women's Media Center Live. I'm Robin Morgan, and I'm going to scurry right back for a conversation with the Renaissance woman, actor, director, and now writer, Christine Lottie. She's coming right up, so don't go away.
You're listening to Women's Media Center Live with Robin Morgan.
And welcome back again. And it gives me great pleasure to welcome back again to this program, Christine Lottie. I'm not going to go into all of her roles that you know her so well for, big screen, small screen, Broadway. You can look those up. Or all the gazillion nominations and awards she's received. You can look those up too. But I will say that she has made choices as an actor of remarkable integrity, choosing to give us back real women, women who are flawed and funny and tragic and strong and vulnerable and courageous. And for that, I thank her. She has mirrored our lives for decades. She also won her first Oscar as a director her first time out. So she has entered, I would say, Renaissance woman territory. And in that capacity, she joins us today because she's gone further and has written her first book. And a delicious book it is. Here is Christine Lottie. Christine, welcome back to the program.
Thank you, Robin. It's a pleasure to be talking to you.
Well, this is a celebratory occasion because we're celebrating true stories from an unreliable witness, a feminist coming of age by Christine Lottie. It's a fierce and lovable book. You want to give it to all your women friends and to a few trustable male friends, and its strength stiffens your spine and it makes you laugh and cry. You pulled it off.
Oh, thank you, Robin. That means so much to me coming from you.
Well, I saw it in performance a couple of times, in the previous couple of years when you were doing it as a performance piece, and it was quite magical even then, but you never know. I thought, well, is this her magic on stage that's, you know, projecting it? Mm-hmm. Will it live by, can it stand by itself on the page or not? And I thought it kind of could. So I put my 2 cents in urging you to make it a book and you pulled it off. You really did.
Thank you. Well, yeah, when I was developing these stories, that's exactly how I did it, as you know, by performing them. A lot of the stories, they were originally monologues.
Right.
And who knew if they would all hold together as a whole collection? And I'm happy to hear that you think they do.
Well, it's also the audacity. You go back and forth in time. You cover the childhood, which warms the heart and chills the soul. Mm-hmm. You know, you were doing Me Too before there was Me Too.
Weren't we all, Robin? This is what we've been talking about since, you know, the late 60s, early 70s. And
right.
We've been dreaming about this.
Right.
Movement, this reckoning, and it's actually happening in our lifetime is so, it's thrilling.
It isn't it? Yeah. Thrilling is really the word. It's very true. But it was hard to be out there saying no when you did it without anybody, with everybody knowing, but nobody doing anything about it, you know?
Exactly. Yeah.
That chapter where you walk mm-hmm. the length of Manhattan after running out of the guy's office, I mean, oh my God.
But I have to say, it's women like you and Gloria Steinem who gave me the strength to say no in that office. That even though the part of me, when this casting director said, the only way you'll get these two commercials is by sleeping with the directors, and that he went on to mansplain to me that that was a reality in show business. And for someone like me, who wasn't conventionally beautiful and who had any connections in show business, that was the only way I was going to make it was to basically become a prostitute. But I, because of my introduction to second wave feminism in college, I had the beginnings of a feminist spine. And I thought, no, I refuse to believe that this is true. Even though there was that, you know, the internalized misogyny that we all grew up with saying, could he be right? Oh my God, could he be right?
Sure.
So that was that walk in Manhattan that I became a feminist in the marrow of my bones.
Well, one of the things that had a click with in the book was where you speak about having thought that you'd have one revelatory, huge click and you'd sort of get feminism only to discover that it never ended. I mean, it's a series of clicks as you go. It's what I call the receding floor, because each time it feels like, like the floor has fallen out from under you, except that until the next time. I mean, not long ago, I learned that there was a movement on for, mostly it's mechanized now, but that there was a movement starting among the women who worked in toll booths on highways mm-hmm. and turnpikes because they're sexually harassed, because men tend to ride through and expose themselves. I mean, who would have thought, you know?
Oh, my God.
I couldn't have imagined that men would do such a thing. And I fell through another's receding floor. So that you're right. That process just never stops. Give us some of the examples that you trace in the book from the relationship with your mother and father. Oh my God. This happy, normal, average, perfect family on the surface. And like every family, the griefs and agonies underneath, all the way straight through this career and how you managed to survive.
Well, that's the thing, is that I've managed to survive, honestly, I feel, because of feminism. I navigated through so much of that classic patriarchal 50s upbringing,
yep.
where my mother was treated like a second-class citizen through the sexism of show business, now through the sexist ageism of show business.
Right.
And my feminism has given me that, has been the wind in my sails, honestly. That's
yeah.
really been my such a source of my strength.
Yeah, it's experiential. It really is in the gut. I mean, all the, God love them, the feminist academics, they're terrific, but the abstractions and the long academies and the theory, pale before the gut realization that this can save your life, you know? I mean, it's amazing.
It can save your life, Robin. That's how I feel. I mean, the reason I wrote this book initially was because of this tsunami of ageism that I was facing in my career.
Yeah.
Suddenly there were no parts, and I felt my story was more, I had so much more to say as an artist than ever. I felt like I was at my creative prime, and yet there were no parts. And my daughter basically said to me, stop sitting around moping and blaming, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
And write your own stuff. So.
Yeah.
I did. And, you know, I'd been an interpreter of other people's stories my whole life. And I decided, okay, I think I'll start trying to tell my story.
Yep. And wow, have you ever. I mean, one of the places in the book you speak about the discovering that there's a real powerlessness in acting because you're dependent on everything else, on the writer, on the director,
yes.
on the ensemble, on the play or the film getting funding. I mean, and so when you discovered or dared try yourself being a director and and won an Oscar for your first time around, ha ha ha, take that, Hollywood, ha ha ha. That must have felt pretty damn good.
That did feel great. I had just given birth to twins, and you can imagine there were no scripts coming to my door in those days. Of course, there were no, you know, getting scripts on the computer. But yeah, it had dried up my career, and I just thought, well, what else can I do? Okay, let me try yeah. directing. And wow, this feels good.
Right.
Wow, this
right.
feels really good to win an Oscar for this.
Yeah.
So yeah,
I love
very empowering.
I love that you've won all sorts of awards and Oscar nominations for the acting, and of course the infamous famous Golden Globe Award when you were in the bathroom, which will be written on your your tombstone. But I love that your Oscar, or your first Oscar, let's always refer to it that way, your Oscar was for directing and for your first time out.
Thank you.
No, really,
I'm very, very happy about it, especially when there's so much, like, thankfully, so much talk and exposure about the lack of women behind cameras. So it's great
yes.
to be kind of encouraged by that
yes.
it can happen. And, you know, if we just keep speaking out loud and dare to tell our stories, and yeah, it's got to happen because we insist that it must.
That's right. That's right. If it can get through that, this also makes money and people also want to see this.
Yes.
And, you know, the other thing that is a real theme in your book, which wow, did I, all my juices started flowing about, was the drive to perfection. Talk about the drive to be perfect.
Right. Well, I grew up thinking that was the only way to be loved by my father in particular. My mother's love was we all felt that it was unconditional.
Okay.
But his was seemed very conditional upon perfection.
Mm.
And if you got an A minus, that there was a lot of disappointment in my father with that minus. So I thought that I could never admit to failing. I mean, I could never fail. I could never admit to making mistakes. You know, the chorus of my childhood was, I didn't do it. I didn't do it.
Uh-huh.
You know, I'm blaming my five siblings. So part of this book was a journey into trying to embrace all my many, many imperfections and in some ways celebrate them, which is finally what I think gave me the most self-respect, because I kept looking for respect outside with awards and trophies and prizes and, you know, applause. And finally it came from, you know, I'm a late bloomer, but it came from within.
Yes. Well, it's very moving. I mean, and it's a hard thing to break through. And then at a certain point, I mean, I was very much fell prey to that. And once I made up a chart, was a week long chart in my sort of 7-year-old shaky hand, And if on each day I got a gold star, for being, you know, for being perfect. And I made it through a whole week and I saved that piece of paper. And when I look at it, my hair just, which is normally very straight, curls in horror. Cause I had to be an adult and an adult who was rapidly aging, before I realized that in fact what was lovable about humanity and each other was imperfection.
Exactly. And it's what, you know, connects us all, is that that shared humanity, that shared imperfection, that shared, you know, inability to get a gold star every day.
Yep, exactly. And you're so honest in this book. Funny and really clear and very wise at moments, but most of all the guts to be really honest and put it out there so we recognize the imperfection and we identify with it. I mean, the story about your sister who was bipolar and killed herself, and the story about your brother and the childhood abuse.
Yeah, well, in my family, there was mental illness, and there was a lot of denial in my family. And my dad, who was a surgeon, you know, he thought, yes, just for my sister who was severely bipolar, just said, basically, take your meds and smile. You don't need therapy. You don't need anything else. Just, you know, hold your head up high, smile, and take your meds. And that didn't really work for my sister. So it was that kind of, and my mom, and for my brother, he was also, he never took it seriously. He was in denial about his own, whatever it was, borderline personality disorder, I think was the final diagnosis. But because of denial and because of that need to be perfect, and I think there was so much missed, so many red flags were missed with my siblings. And I think that the journey to be honest, the challenge to be really honest in this book, that was challenging for me. I had my daughter, my husband, my friends, my editors who kept saying, go deeper, go more honest. And that was challenging because for someone, again, who was used to denial and trying to be perfect, it was scary and very vulnerable making, by the way, the fact that this book is actually coming out and people are reading it and I don't get to get in there and change anything anymore.
Oh, I know that feeling. Yeah. Yeah.
But, I know you do.
Yeah. But no, let me tell you, when you're sitting there and you're writing and you have sweaty palms and mild nausea, or not mild nausea, real heavy nausea, and you think, oh my God, I can't publish it, you know, and then you sort of tell yourself, well, I don't have to publish it. I'll just get it down, you know.
Right.
And then
right.
Eventually you do publish it and you think, oh, I am the only person in the world. Everybody's going to, oh my God. And then, you know, the miracle happens, which is that mail and at book signings, I know you're going to go on book tour with this.
Mm-hmm.
People come up and they send you letters and they tweet you and they Facebook you, they post saying, oh my God, you too. It's like one giant, massive consciousness racing group where the moment of recognition, you're not crazy, you're not alone. I had that exact same, or I had very close to that, or oh my God, you've helped me realize. And that, Christine, is incredibly validating and fear erasing. I mean, it really fills you up for next time. You know what I mean?
I do, and that is my hope, that people will relate to these stories and maybe they won't feel so alone, or they could, it might help, you know, give them the courage to be imperfect like
yes,
I am.
Yes, yes, yes.
Yeah.
Well, oh, you, only you alone in the whole human race are imperfect. Well, my God.
That's how it feels sometimes.
Yeah, how can I possibly stoop to having you as a friend? My God. You're
exactly.
Your warmth and your love comes through. I mean, and the triumphs as well. I mean, it's 34, 35 year old marriage and, between a major Hollywood actor and director, and a major Hollywood director. That's not what you call common out there or anywhere these days. You know,
it's not. Yeah. And we call it, you know, it's like 285 dog years because that translates into that because it is so rare. But, yeah, I mean, part of our secret, I think, is that we don't spend all the time together. We
right.
each have careers that we love and are passionate about and fortunately still working quite a bit. And we go do our work and come back and share our adventures and journeys and go back out and do it again.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it's just, and particularly considering the family that you came from, which was the ideal family in those days.
Right.
You know, it's a total transformation of that, matrix of that, pattern, and a really triumphant one.
I really didn't know if I would be able to find a man who didn't want to squish me in some way or diminish me or hold me back. I just didn't trust it. I never had a role model to really see a couple. I mean, all my girlfriends' moms were housewives and were treated with disrespect, I felt. I didn't see it out in the world, really. So it was hard finding Tommy. And I think they are out there, those men that are truly feminist men. But they're hard to find.
Yes. Yeah. And the portrait of your mother is so moving and heartbreaking and maddening all at the same time, with a fixed, permanent, cheerful smile and trilling voice and always serving the perfect food and the right, you know, and then mm-hmm. what lay underneath it, which you saw and which she finally admitted and broke through, but very, you know, late in her life. It's just, I think of my mother. Mm-hmm. I mean, it just, and there was no women's movement at that moment for them. So we're, nobody to say you too. Although you began to be that for her, actually, toward the end. And she could confide in you. So that in itself was, you know, a winning through to some other level of clarity that I think you should be really proud of.
Yeah. Thank you. I do think that my feminism and my awakening did rub off on her and helped her, I think, break through some of her own internalized misogyny that she had grown up with.
Yeah, well, and she began painting and she, you know, became serious about that in large, no small part because of your influence. So that's right. You
and
know.
She was a pilot.
She
started to fly a plane.
Yeah, I love that. I love that she did that. She took wings. Yeah. Literally, she took wings. Oh,
yeah.
Christine, this book is just like having drinks with a real good girlfriend. True stories from an unreliable eyewitness, humor and wit in the title, A Feminist Coming of Age by Christine Lottie. And it's just, as I say, it's a lovable, fierce, funny, wise book. And with a great cover. You cannot look at this cover without grinning. There's a absolutely beautiful woman on the front of it, who's laughing with rumpled hair. And she does not look like she's all puffed up and trying to be 22, and she exudes humor and power, not power over, but power to. So thank you for that, my friend.
Oh, thank you, Robin. This has been delightful talking to you and so heartening, because you're one of the first people I've talked to about my book. You're one of the first people who's read it. So I'm really, really flattered and means a lot to me.
Well, when you go on the book tour, they do not assume they have read anything. But they might, and you are always welcome to come back here and let your hair down anytime you want. And thank you for being with us today. And hey, thank you for being you and for writing this book. It's a winner. It's really a winner. I'm so proud you're a pal.
Thank you, Robin. And thank you for all the inspiration you have given me over in lifetime. You really were one of the first who taught me that it was okay to say no to these men and walk out of the room and hold my head up high.
We have to take one last break here at Women's Media Center Live. I'm Robin Morgan, and I'll return directly with some fighting words.
You're listening to Women's Media Center Live with Robin Morgan.
Welcome back again to some fighting words.
Mm-hmm.
This week, I want to focus on a small story that got insufficient coverage in the Trump glut of news. It's merely about two of the most important founding principles of our republic, freedom of speech and freedom of religion. You may have heard that on April 16th, House Speaker Paul Ryan announced that Father Patrick Conroy, a Jesuit priest and the House chaplain since 2011, would be stepping down. It turned out that he was not leaving voluntarily, but that the Speaker's chief of staff had told Conroy, resign or be fired. Conroy had duly submitted a letter of resignation to take effect May 24th, but in rode Nancy Pelosi, House Minority Leader and former Speaker herself. Pelosi takes her Catholicism as seriously as she does her politics. She once endured estrangement from her mother, with whom she was usually very close, who stopped speaking to her for almost 6 years after Pelosi insisted on remaining true to her pro-choice position. Well, now Nancy was stubbornly fighting for Conroy, and as other members of the House from both sides of the aisle, Catholic or not, signed on to his defense, it became, well, a thing. It seems that anti-Conroy feeling had been building for some time, particularly started by Christian evangelical representatives who felt that this priest was living up to his Jesuit order's reputation as being liberal and intellectual a little bit too much. For example, the chaplain, by tradition, sometimes invites members of other faiths to deliver the congressional morning prayer in his stead, and Conroy had invited a Muslim imam, not just once, but twice. Gasp, gasp. Then, when the House was debating their ultra-conservative tax bill, Conroy had dared say in his morning prayer, quote, may their efforts these days guarantee that there are not winners and losers under new tax laws, but benefits balanced and shared by all Americans, close quote. Well, that's wildly radical, huh? Speaker Ryan then warned Conroy, Padre, you just gotta stay out of politics. Tell it to the loaves and fishes guy, Paul. Anyway, at some point, after tendering his letter, Conroy realized that he'd been elected to the post by the whole House, and that Ryan could not demand his resignation after all. So he withdrew it, and said if they wanted him gone, they'd actually have to fire him, without his cooperation. Ryan should have known better not to mess with the Jesuits. The Jetties usually win. The Speaker of the House backed down. Conroy has been reinstated. All of which would be a small, amusing story about politically hypocritical religiosity. Except for a little thing called the Constitution. Except for a small group of radicals called the Framers. Freedom of speech does not stop at the doors of the House of Representatives. Freedom of religion, by the way, also means the freedom to follow no religion. Most of the framers were, in fact, agnostics, atheists, free thinkers, or deists believing in a god of science or nature, and they were obsessed with the separation of church and state. In my book, Fighting Words, A Toolkit for Combating the Religious Right, after which this segment, Fighting Words, is named, I quoted the framers at length, and their words are incredibly bracing. For instance, James Madison, called the father of the Constitution, opposed all use of, quote, religion as an engine of civil policy. He prophesied accurately the threat of, quote, ecclesiastical corporations. In his great text titled Monopolies, Perpetuities, Corporations, Ecclesiastical Endowments, that was circa 1817 when he penned that, he wrote, is the appointment of chaplains to the two houses of Congress consistent with the Constitution and with the pure principle of religious freedom? In strictness, the answer on both points must be in the negative. The establishment of the chaplainship to Congress is a palpable violation of equal rights as well as of constitutional principles. better also to disarm in the same way the precedent of chaplainship for the Army and Navy. Religious proclamations by the executive branch, even recommending thanksgivings and fasts, are shoots from the same root. Such acts seem to imply and certainly nourish the erroneous idea of a national religion. Close quote. George Washington was a Freemason and a deist, always referring to divinity carefully as it, and never mentioning the name of Jesus Christ in any of his literally thousands of letters. He was criticized for so rarely attending church, and when he did, he stood during prayers while others knelt, and he always made a point of leaving before communion. John Adams was a radical Unitarian, deeply influenced by the Enlightenment. Ben Franklin called himself a deistic scientist. Then there's Thomas Paine. My own mind is my church. And of course, books full of quotes from Jefferson, not least of which is, "Question with boldness even the existence of a God." How far, how tragically far we have fallen away already from the vision of the founders. When a Jesuit priest is censored for mentioning the rights of poorer citizens of the Republic, and when he does so as chaplain of the House of Representatives, a post itself in violation of the Constitution. Those are my fighting words. Add yours on Twitter, and remember to tag us at WMC Live and use the hashtag Fighting Words. That's it for today. This program is syndicated, but if you can't find the broadcast on a radio station in your area, you can always visit us at WMCLive.com for the show, plus the archive of all our previous episodes. You can also stream, download, and subscribe to our show's podcast at iTunes, at Stitcher, and at Google Play. Be sure to find WMC Live on Facebook and Twitter, and you can check out my website and blog at robinmorgan.net and find me on Facebook and Twitter, too. My latest book, Dark Matter, New Poems, is available online and off wherever books are sold. Portions of this program were taped earlier. Opinions expressed here do not necessarily represent the WMC. Here's the family for Women's Media Center Live. Executive producer as well as founding and sustaining sponsor, Regina K. Scully. WMC president and co-executive producer of this program, Julie Burton. And I'm Robin Morgan, your producer and host. Thank you for being with us. And don't forget to join us next week right here on Women's Media Center Live.
For the smartest talk about news, politics, sex, books, religion, race, and more, tune your radio to Women's Media Center Live with Robin Morgan. Audacious, witty, provocative, informative, and fun. It's Women's Media Center Live with Robin Morgan on WMCLive.com. Talk radio with a brain.